Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the O2 Podcast. Tonight, you've got Paul and Andrew, and we are fresh off of our trip down south to Send It Slam. Paul, how are you? Are you recovered yet?
What a good one. What a damn good weekend, man. Good event, good music. Well, archery shoot was fun. I had a blast.
Yeah, I wanna dive deep into that because it was pretty.
Oh, man. It was cool. Wild Send It Slam. We've been talking about it for weeks. We got to experience it. Those folks on the Go Wild crew, elite.
They know how to throw a party. People.
They do. You're damn right they do.
So let's dive into that right now. So if you weren't paying attention to us in the last, I don't know how many weeks, but, and that's completely possible. We've been talking about the Go Wild Send It Slam, and that was the event down in Louisville that our friends at Go Wild put on. And it started, so Paul and I went down, we took the families, we went down Friday afternoon, got down there, got settled, got up Saturday morning, went to the archery shoot, so they had a 3D course, what was it,
25 targets.
Rain
from the moment we got there.
It was like 3D archery in a rainforest.
It was pretty cool.
Pacific Northwest.
We go to hunt or to warm up, and we met the ultimate hunting douche. I don't know this guy's name. We're going to call him William. William, if everyone wants to know, warms up at 100 yards.
Yes, he does. That's where he warms up.
Warms up at 100 yards. Yep, and starts. That's where he starts. So this guy would not shut up about himself. I mean, to the point where I was just like, I'm done. I slung like 5 arrows. And I'm like, I'm out.
We were all done.
Yo, we could. Yeah, there were 5 of us there. We couldn't listen to this guy talk anymore.
And then the funniest part, well, not funniest part, was we were about halfway through the course, and we looked behind us.
Bitch.
You got to be kidding me. Because guess who was behind us?
William. William the hunting douche. Oh, my God.
Old Bill.
And he's so, like, for those of you that golf, like, there's always that one guy when you golf that's like, oh, you know, adjust your grip, adjust your feet, you're banging. Shut up. You're pissing me off. You are making me worse at golf. That's how he was. He tried to like correct all of us, and I was just like, listen, man, like, I don't care what you have to say. I'm a shitty bow hunter. I'm a shitty archer. Leave me alone. You're not going to change anything.
I'm not saying what he wasn't telling us the truth on stuff. You might, man, good for you if you warm up in 100 yards or you pull out your $46 rangefinder you got on Amazon that has fog mode that you push a button and all of a sudden goes clear.
Vaporizes the fog.
Yes.
Vaporizes.
So that as I'm sitting here struggling with the stupid, anyways, the best part though had to have been when we got to the very end and was it Jacob or whoever was running the thing and like, so how many bullseyes did you get? Or did you get any bullseyes?
We had like 4 in our group.
In the group.
Over 25 holes. 4.
Right.
We had 4 bullseyes.
And we are not William. Okay.
No.
But he's like, oh, yeah, you know, like, let's see. 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9. I haven't got to the back ones yet. I'm like,
I just walked away. I'm like, I cannot listen to this guy talk
bro,
anymore.
Bro, you shot by yourself. So why don't you just tell him you had 25 bullseyes? Like, anyways.
Every one of them.
But let's talk about that, Paul.
Uh-oh.
Let's talk about the one that really mattered, okay?
Which one was that?
The one across the water.
130. I ranged it at like 134. So it was all over. So we'll just say 130 yards.
So did you pull out your 134 pin? Is that how you
did
it?
Yeah, I pulled out. Well, because I had been warming up at 100 all morning. So I was pretty confident in my accurate reading there, but
the
cross upon.
Crosswind. Yeah, the crosswind. It was like 6.5 miles an hour.
Yep. And there was like, what's the Coriolis effect or whatever? Like, mm-hmm. The, you know, I had all that. I had the
not if the Earth's flat. There's no Coriolis.
No, yeah, I had the humidity and the barometric. I had all these ratings, which none of that is true. I just I put my pin, my 60-yard pin, which I have sighted in, I put it on the elk, and I raised it up to, like, I don't know, above the trees. That's the
moon.
Drilled it. First shot.
It was unbelievable. So we walk up to this.
Drilled it. Bullseye. Well, not really bullseye, but pretty damn close.
They had an elk, a bedded elk, about 130 yards across the pond.
Full size, yeah. Full size 3D target.
And I don't know. We walked up. We were one of the later groups, and they had said there was only like three guys that hit.
No. There was one other guy before us and two guys from our group. There were three total for the entire day that hit the 10 ring.
Okay, inside the 10 ring. Yep. Now, you walk up, very first shot, stick the damn 10 Boom. Ring.
Drilled it.
Everybody, of course, I'm sitting there, and I'm like, Paul, you've been a ringer this whole time telling us that you're the world's worst bow hunter, and here you go. Like,
I had a good day.
You had a great day.
I had a good day.
I was impressed, man.
But so the second shot, 40 yards short, planked
right in water.
Right in the water. And everyone, you know, like the bow hunting league guys were shocked. They're like, where were you aiming? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I totally panicked. So I was trying to remember where I was aiming on my first shot. Didn't even get close. The third shot, because you got three, the third one I put... it hit you could hear it hit brush like right in front of the elk, and then it just kind of like landed right in the water. But it was cool. Good event.
Yeah. And then,
old cousin Vince, he hit the ass of the elk. And
Vinny hit the elk.
Yep. Jay Rush hit the 10 ring.
Justin's shot was close to the bullseye.
He almost drilled it. I mean, his shot was closer than mine.
When I was looking at the picture on that, I mean, you guys were inches away from him. It was unbelievable.
Yep.
And, let's see what I put. Two for sure in the water, maybe one in the bank, and they
sank. One for sure in the bank.
They sank right to the bottom. So it turns out that
high FOCs went.
the heavier arrows did not do too well with the long.
I had no desire to shoot my serious arrows into the. I didn't want to lose them. I just got them. I'm still trying. So I used the non-adult arrows, but they did me good. They did me well. So
you know what? For something like that, you're flying flat and. You know, straight and fast. Yeah. That doesn't.
So
no
yeah,
shame there. But what happens, Paul? What happened later in the day that we found out because you hit that elk?
I won a bear archery bow of my choice.
So Paul's trip was completely paid for. when they called his name, and I don't think your wife realized it. I was like, Ashley, that's probably like $1,000 bow.
But, yeah, because I've been like hinting to her that I'm like, because the last bow that I bought it in 2010. So I mean. This thing's old. I mean, like, I took it to Performance Archery there in Newark, had Mike look at it, and, you know, he's like, when did you buy this? But I'm like, 2010. He's like, yeah, that cam technology is from, like, the mid-90s. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, and it's a good bow. I mean, I've had some success with it, and it was time. Like, shoot next to you guys, like, shoot next to you and shoot next to Vince who have newer bows. I mean, the sound, the performance, I mean, it was painfully obvious that it was time for an upgrade, but... You know, she treated me good one last time, so I'm going to hang it up in my office.
I would,
paint that some bitch gold or something. I don't know.
Yes.
I should have saved the arrow.
Congratulations to you, my friend, because that is awesome.
What was really funny is, like, four holes before that, I drilled a tree. I was just tired. Yes. I couldn't see. I was sweaty. That guy was pissing me off.
William,
hunting douche William, was under my skin, and... He's like, oh, it sounds like someone hit a tree. I'm like, I'm gonna kill this guy.
Oh yeah, he was proud of you too because you hit right square in the middle of the tree.
I wanted to hit that guy. When he said that. He's like, I was dead center of the tree. I'm just like, oh, dude, you motherfucker,
wasn't aiming for the tree.
But what really makes me mad is he didn't see that shot on the elk. I would have spiked the football. Hey, William, what'd you do that, buddy?
Yeah, warm up at 100 yards. Yeah.
Good time though. Hell of an event. Thanks to Go Wild.
No, and then
thanks to Bear Archery. Appreciate you guys.
That was the archery part. The 3D was great. Then we got downtown.
Jacob and Braden did a hell of a job setting that
up. Yes. Shout out to Jacob and Braden because really the whole team. When we got downtown at the amphitheater, they had the concert going. At some local beer distributors.
Beers were good.
Oh, those were real good. Yeah. Some family friendly events.
Shooting BBs, and it was cool, man. It was a fun event. We saw the Raise Them Outdoors gal was there letting kids shoot bows, and it was neat.
The BB gun thing was funny. I don't know how much you were paying attention. I was watching my two kids. My daughter is completely calculated. She got about two or three shots down range in the same amount of time. I think little man had like 25 shots down range. He just like
ripping them,
and of course he tells everybody he knows what he's doing, so he's like, I got one of these at home. He's a hunting douche in the making right there.
He should have been yelling send it the entire time.
Yeah. But then he had his lucky fishing hat that he got from the Kentucky DNR.
That was cool. That was a cool hat. It had all the game fish, native game fish from Kentucky. That was pretty sweet. That was a cool hat.
No, but so for those of you who weren't there, it was raining, okay? It wasn't really supposed to rain. I think the rain was supposed to stop by about 9 a.m.
It started at 8:30. It didn't stop until about 4
o'clock, I think. So to the vendors that stuck around, thank you. That was great. The kids loved it.
We got some cool stuff down there.
Oh, my gosh. We got some Dano's. Shout out to Dano's Seasoning because we got a lot of Dano's.
Dude, I have enough Dano's to season an entire cow. Like, I could like a 1,000-pound cow.
Yeah, we could dry rub that thing pretty good.
It was good stuff, though.
It was. I actually used it tonight. But what else is down there? I mean, I can't say enough about the work that Brad and Jacob, Braden,
Dan,
Erica, all those guys, Zach, Chris. They put a lot of work into that, man. A
ton of work.
And then the music itself was local.
Oh, man.
Local, yeah. And it was real Kentucky music. It was, and it was good. That Cole Chaney, man, he rocked that.
He was good. Justin Wells was good. I can't remember her last name, but Abby was good. Yeah. There was a guy before the very Dalton, first musician. So. Yeah, Dalton maybe. He was, dude, he killed it. They all did it. They did a great job. But Cole Chaney, that guy is a freaking star in the making, man. And he is just, if you've never listened to his music, YouTube him. I mean, he is good. Cole Chaney and the, what was it, Wolfpin Branch,
something like that.
Man, those guys were awesome.
The music was incredible. And then Cole's got a really unique sound. It was kind of Chris Stapleton, kind of Aaron Lewis, and
no drums. It was just a string band, which was really, really neat. So yeah, I enjoyed that. We've got a lot to look forward to for next year. I think it's gonna be fun.
Yeah,
that event, Send It Slam, I hope they do it again. It's just gonna get bigger and bigger. So
yeah. So, and really, once they start planning that one out, you guys, I highly suggest.
It's a lot of fun. Speaking of events, August 27th, Vance's in Columbus, Tethered Teach and Train event. That's going to be fun. TetheredNation.com. Still haven't gotten up in it all the way. I mean, I'm like 6 feet off the ground. I'm working up to it. So
yeah, we need to get in that. But this weekend we got archery hike.
Yeah.
So Friday, Saturday, Sunday down there in Hocking Hills.
Yep, archeryhike.com. Check it out. There's still some spots available for Friday and Sunday, I believe. There's also a big beer fest going on in Athens. Does that start on Friday, or does it? I think you can get on Facebook or Google it or something, but there's a bunch of like breweries, and Munz is going to figure it out, so I'll just keep talking. But breweries, distilleries, whatever. There's a big event. So you can go to Archery Hike, sling some arrows, enter to win a Matthews bow. Have some fun, head on down south. I think it wasn't Nelsonville. I'm pretty sure that it was in Athens. So I don't know, maybe another half hour down 33, you're going to be in beer heaven. So Court Street. It was on Court Street, if I remember. So that's for sure Athens.
Ohio Brew Week. OhioBrewWeek.com.
If you've never been on Court Street in Athens, buckle up, my friend. I mean, all them crazy college kids aren't there this time of year, but oh, man. Court Street, that is a
holy
legendary
smokes,
place.
Dude. It's a 9-day festival of Ohio brewing and fermenting.
Oh, man. Yeah. I love fermented anything, so sign me up. Yeah, sign me up. What else we got? First Light, firstlight.com. I got the Catalyst system. That thing's awesome. Can't wait to get they've got some duck hunting stuff coming out, some waterfowl gear. Oh, man, I'm ready for it.
So. Yeah, I've been kind of holding off talking a whole lot because I want to get the details on all that stuff and once it's released. And
I don't know when it's coming. They don't tell us.
So. They said July, so I think.
Well, it's July.
By the end of July, they should have all their stuff released for the year, and then we're going to get somebody on to talk about it.
Uncle Steve, better hurry up and get that duck hunting stuff in. You know, the only thing that's kind of annoying is I've lost so much weight, so I bought that Catalyst system and those pants. Like they're too big. Because I've lost 2 pant sizes since I ordered those, so
I'm
just going to tighten up the the suspenders and ride it out the rest of the year.
You know, it's always my mom always told me if you had to buy new clothes because you lost weight, that's a good problem.
That is a good thing. So,
but, let's see. Shout out to a couple reviews that we got here.
Oh yeah, these are good. I appreciate the reviews. Thanks for the love. We asked for it. You guys delivered in hilarious fashion. Thank you so much. If you feel so inclined to give us a review, do so. Apple, Android, Spotify, Podbean, wherever else you listen to. If you leave a review, hit us up on social media. We'll send you some cool stuff. If you don't care about that stuff, leave a review. These are hilarious. You know, one of my favorite things is when people leave us reviews. I love to look at the like the names. Yeah, Andrew.
So
what do we got? What's the first?
The first one was Balls 59476. I love it. So, and then
I love it. That's my kind of humor right there.
The second one, I got to read this because it's hilarious. From Swanny 74,
or is it Swanny 74?
Or Swanny? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Fun what show to nice? Listen to. Mostly bow deer hunting. Their turkey stuff is great too.
Oh, and here it comes. Here's the funny part.
You really need to hear one of them use a diaphragm turkey call. It's the best. Ha ha. I showed that to my wife.
Oh my gosh. I did. Great. I did too. She's just like, the fact that I gagged on the radio so much, or you know, it's not a radio show, whatever. That was funny. I'm glad you guys enjoyed that.
That was good.
Keep listening. We appreciate the support. We appreciate the reviews. You know, we're just trying to have fun, man. Have fun, lighten your day up, learn a little bit. We're going to kick our deer hunting talk off.
First, we're going to get you an update from Nick Moen and his tournament bass fishing.
Yeah.
But then we're going to talk some deer. So, obviously, you know, whitetails in Ohio is a big deal. We won't be exclusively deer here for the rest of the year, but it's going to be a big, big portion of it. So,
A lot like the turkey. We got some really good guests lined up. We'll do our deer series. We'll talk about some really, you know, neat strategies, talk to some really successful people. We've got some really big name, really interesting people lined up. I think it's going to be really neat. Munts, I'm working on a special guest that you don't know about, and I'm not going to tell you who it is until they sign into the Zoom. When you think of deer hunting in this country, this is one of the first people that pop up in your mind, anybody's mind. And I'm not telling you. I've been working on this in secret, so. It's gonna happen.
Paul, I don't like secrets.
I love watching you sweat, man, and get all nervous.
You know it. You know how I am too, because just like when we were walking through the woods shooting at things, when I've got became a head case and I couldn't hit the broadside of a damn barn.
So we're shooting at this turkey, and I like downhill shot angles and all that stuff. I'm too dumb to figure out like angles, but you got that fancy Vortec thing you got from Bill Wild.
It didn't matter.
So I hit the target. This guy puts it underneath the target, goes underneath the target and sticks into a tree. And after that, you were toast after that. So
I was a bit rattled.
After we had to walk back up that hill, that's when I started getting shaky. Oh, man.
It started with the stupid stabilizer. I couldn't get my stabilizer screwed back in, and that was driving me crazy. But
yeah.
Anywho, back to this week's talk. So we're talking the deer up in the Killdeer Plains area. So, like, the actual details are in the discussion episode itself, but you know, we've got that's the CWD area, that's the hot zone, that's the area where we're gonna have an early season,
starts September 10th, and then there's a gun season in like mid-October.
Yeah,
so
early.
Yeah,
they're trying to take the numbers down, right?
Yeah, they are.
We talked to
Bob Ford,
Clint, and then
Mike Tonkovich, friend of the program. And then Clint is just one of the biologists that does really good work. Three really smart guys. These guys have their finger on the pulse of deer herd management and deer herd health in the state of Ohio. So this is not just Killdeer Plains. If you're like, I'm never going to hunt Killdeer Plains, I'm not going to listen to it. There's a lot of discussion that is, it translates to every corner, every county in this state that the DNR does. This is a really good... It's a good topic. It's a good conservation topic. It's a good hunting discussion. CWD. I mean, we didn't talk a ton about that. It was more about like the practice of why we're doing this and what we're seeing. So it was a really neat discussion. I think you guys will enjoy it. But it's a good kickoff to I think the deer talk that we've got coming. So
yep, pretty excited about that. So let's see. I don't think we got anything else. We'll get into the show, but the o2podcast.com is the website, the.o2.podcast on Instagram. Follow us there. We've got go wild. It's the o2podcast.
Or Paul Campbell. Don't follow Andrew Muntz. That guy never responds.
What a jerk. Ohio Hunt is the Twitter. What else?
Dude, I haven't been on that Twitter. So if you guys are, if anyone's of the 50 people that follow us on Twitter.
Most people like add social media accounts. And we're like removing them.
Oh God, I'm so sorry. Yeah, if you're communicating with me, please forgive me. I'm not ignoring you. So
yeah.
I'm just. But, yeah, Elon Musk chased me off, I guess. I'm just kidding.
Oh, shoot. God. Well, I think if that's all we got, Paul, then we will. We'll talk next week.
I think that's it. Send us a review, man. Thanks for the love. Thanks for the support. Have a great weekend.
Take care, guys. Hey, guys. I know we said we were going to have Nick Moen on to give us an update on the his fishing bass tournament stuff, but I was just working on putting all this together and realized that I forgot to hit the record button with Nick. So next week we will have Nick on to talk. So with that, we'll go right into our discussion with all of the Ohio deer people of importance. So enjoy. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the O2 podcast. Today we are joined with our We've got them all, man. Paul and I were able to talk to our buddy, Mr. Tonk, and get us some of the brightest deer minds in Ohio. We've got Clint McCoy and Bob Ford, along with Mike Tonkovich from the state of Ohio, to join us. How's everybody doing today?
Doing well, Andrew. Thanks.
Well, things are well here in Athens.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Pleasure to be back.
Yep. So, Mike, you've been on with us a couple times. The last time we were on, we really recapped the Ohio deer season for 21-22. We talked about harvest numbers. We had Lindsay Thomas from the National Deer Association on. And then we talked a lot about the CWD. So, as I kind of alluded to there earlier, the reason that spurred this idea, this call, was I went up to Killdeer Plains. I had won that turkey lottery, so I spent 3 days up there in one of the units chasing birds, but obviously being a wildlife refuge area, I don't know what the official designation of that area is, but you saw a lot of wildlife, and there was a lot of questions that came up for me, both on the turkey side, but also on the deer side. And that area being kind of a hot spot with CWD, and I'm not going to lie, I mean, I felt like I saw more deer in there than I've ever seen in my life. So your mind starts wondering, you know, you get massive populations, and then sometimes that's where you end up with disease issues and that kind of stuff. And that's what we'll get into today a little bit as a kind of a precursor. But I don't know, Clint and Bob, do you guys want to give everybody a rundown of exactly what your positions are within the state?
Sure. I'll go first. Clint McCoy. I'm the deer biologist. I work hand in hand with Tonk to run the deer program for the state of Ohio. So me specifically, I'd say I'm more, if either one of us are field guys, I guess I'd be more of the field guy, kind of in the air, in the helicopter doing deer counts, you know, analyzing harvest data, analyzing survey data, creating surveys, sending them out to our hunters, and all those sorts of things. So kind of really anything related to deer is kind of where I fall into place.
And I'll go next. So Bob Ford, I'm the wildlife management supervisor for Wildlife District 2, which is the 20 counties in Northwest Ohio, which includes Wyandotte County and Killdeer Plains wildlife area. My job is basically to oversee the wildlife management research programs and projects within those 20 counties, oversee things such as public land management as one of the many things, and then also collection of data specifically to the deer program, the things that Clint and Tonk need from the field to make informed decisions. My staff are the implementation part of that process where we actually physically go out and do the data collection. So so that's kind of been my role here. And then we also oversee the controlled hunts that occur in our district.
Very good. So Clint, you're kind of over this whole state. Bob, you've kind of got that Northwest portion, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, in a nutshell.
Okay. I guess before we get into killdeer specifically or some of that, do we want to talk a little bit about any updates on the CWD side of things? I think that since, Mike, we talked last, we've come out with some updated testing results and some new or more deer that had tested positive. When was the last time we talked? I think it was about February. It was right after the season had ended, so.
Yeah, I don't recall exactly, Andrew, but yeah, we certainly can go over that. Let me see what I've got committed to memory. So we ended up with 9 total positives this year. 8 of those were collected during surveillance during the hunting season, and then we had a 4 nights of post hunt removals conducted by USDA Wildlife Services. They removed 180 deer, and we ended up with an additional adult female that was positive. So that brought our total 9 positives out of almost 1,300 deer sampled this year. So add that, you know, of course, and then we ended up, we don't need to review history, but we had 2 last year. So we're sitting at 9 this year, 2 last year.
Were those across the entire state, or is that just in that?
That was just within the disease surveillance area. Yeah, we tested almost 4,400 deer across the entire state, and that would have been all but about 24, 22 counties, somewhere in that vicinity. There were 22 counties, I think, 22. This is where Clint always helps me out, remember things. 22 or 24 counties that we did not sample, and it may have even been 26. I don't recall, Andrew, but that 4,300, almost 4,400 would have been statewide. The 1,100 or almost 1,300 total. Like it was like 1,108, I think, and then we added another 180. So rounding up, we were just sitting shy of 1,300 deer in that disease surveillance area.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to hold you accountable if you're off by a couple there, Mike. So we'll be all right. Now, are those voluntary tests, or were these state kind of required type of tests that you guys were doing?
It was a combination. Yeah, it would have been a combination. So we had 2 weekends in November, what we deem to be, peak bow weekends in early November that were mandatory testing. And then we had the 7-day gun season that was mandatory testing. So a total of 11 days where hunters were required to submit their deer for testing. And then outside of that, we would have collected any number of other sources, such as voluntary hunter submissions. They could have submitted samples in any number of self-serve kiosks starting at the nearly the start of the season through the end of the season. We had controlled hunts in there on the Killdeer Plains refuge. We would have drawn samples from taxidermists for those 3 counties or from the of course, the problem with taxidermists, Andrew, let me clarify that, is that because only portions of Hardin and Marion counties were in there, we couldn't generally assign a Marion or Hardin County taxidermist sample to the DSA. It would have been just assigned to the county because we would have had no idea in many cases. Now, there were some cases where we could have put it in a township and put it in the DSA if the records were complete. But of course, Wyandotte County, any deer that was harvested in Wyandotte County, since the entire county was in the DSA, those taxidermist samples, those processor samples, those road kills, and suspects, that should have captured just about all sources of those samples. Pretty typical, I might say, for most states. I mean, that's, you get a collection of a myriad of different sample sources.
Gotcha. So, I mean, 9 positives is not good, but out of 1,300, is that, I mean, we try to look at the bright side of things. I feel like, I hear numbers from Wisconsin, which obviously that's really bad, where you're getting 6 out of 10. Bucks off of a farm that are testing positive and stuff. So 9 out of 1,300 sounds like we're in a better spot.
Well, yeah, that's a great way to look at it, Andrew. And of course, Bob and Clint, both you guys can chip in at any time. But I think the more important question is, yeah, that's incredibly low. That's less than 1% across the entire disease surveillance area, right, amongst adults. But then the question becomes, okay, so that's not so bad. But what does the, you know, when we start talking about the future, it's the start of something, unfortunately. We haven't declared CWD victorious by any stretch of the imagination yet, but another year or two at most, and I think we'll know for sure what we're dealing with. So the question, of course, Andrew, that late in the game, as we prepared for these two open houses last week in Marion and Wyandotte counties, one of the things that occurred to me is someone's going to ask, you know, what are the odds that you may have collected all nine positives out there in a population, in that population across the disease surveillance area? And the answer is effectively zero. And to put things in maybe a little bit of perspective for you, another way of looking at that is we had to, in order to answer that question, you had to come up with, even though it was just a ballpark estimate, we had to generate a population estimate for that DSA, and again, rather large confidence intervals around this, but we settled on about 8,000 deer. So the question, of course, is, you know, what are the odds if there are only nine positives and you scooped 1,200 out of there that you would get all nine positives? One of my good friends from Minnesota put it this way. He said, well, Mike, you'd have a 50% chance of doing that, provided, now this is just a 50% chance of collecting all nine positives, provided that you removed 7,804 of those 8,000 deer. So the reality is, while that's an incredibly low prevalence rate, it means most likely will mean work ahead for us.
Bob, when you're up there in that part of the state, what's the feeling on the ground from your hunters and stuff? Are they willing to help out and help you guys with collecting, or is it something that it's getting a little bit pushback?
I think that there's a mixed bag, so to speak. We have a tremendous number of folks in our area that are genuinely interested and, you know, are happy to assist us. And you know, we've taken advantage of that and their efforts. It's because of their efforts that we know what we know, and we're genuinely thankful for their participation, regardless of, you know, when things are mandatory or voluntary. We've had a tremendous participation, but obviously, you know, the more that we get, the better informed we'll be. So yeah, I think generally speaking, we've had a good response. There are some individuals who, you know, obviously may not align with our thought process, but generally speaking, you know, it's a matter of communication and working together. So, and as we move forward, we'll figure out how to do that.
Just recapping on the process for the testing and stuff. So I shoot a monster buck. I'm super excited. I got my grip and grins. I've showed all my, you know, friends and everything, put it on all my social media, but I want to eat it. Right. So, but I want to get it tested first. What's the process look like just for people, you know, really across the state in general? I mean, you can take it to your kiosk and stuff, but then do you take it to the harvest or the processor? Do you start processing it yourself? Do you just put it in the freezer and wait? And what kind of timeline do you have on that?
Well, Bob, you want to I guess take I'll, that? Yeah, I can take that. So I guess, you know, that there's a whole lot of questions in there and I'll try and break it down as best as I can. So if you are hunting in the disease surveillance area, and you have the opportunity to harvest something that you would like to have mounted and put on the wall, you know, there's a couple things to consider. Number one is carcass regulations. So, you know, as far as understanding, you know, what those regulations are before you can move it move that carcass out of the disease surveillance area. So, you know, the rule is right now you cannot move high-risk parts out of that disease surveillance area, which include, you know, the spinal column, the brain, things of that nature, unless it goes to a certified CWD certified taxidermist and or processor. So that's one part of this. The second thing is, as far as getting the deer sampled, if you take that deer to a collection station, inspection station, or a kiosk, one of the first things you're going to come to understand is, if you bring it to a kiosk, there's instructions that say do not leave the head here. The last thing that the Division of Wildlife wants to do is to mess up anybody's mount. So leaving it at a kiosk is not an option, because obviously, you know, it would be hard to not only return the head back to the individual, but it would just, there's no option there to get it mounted, you know, moving forward. The other thing is that if the hunter arrives at one of the inspection stations during the mandatory period, first thing we're going to do is ask, hey, are you planning to get this deer mounted? And if the hunter says yes, or is unsure, we will not do any cutting on that head. We're hoping that head will go to a taxidermist that we can work with to pull the tissue sample. But again, if you were to take that deer head outside of that disease surveillance area, it would definitely, per the carcass regulations, have to go to a CWD certified taxidermist, regardless of if they were participating in our sampling or not. So, but we're going to try and work with all the taxidermists and processors moving forward, and try and figure out a good way to get that tissue sample. As far as getting the results in relation to processing, you know, if you plan to consume that that deer, you know, we are pursuing avenues to expedite the time it takes to get test results back. But, you know, inevitably, especially when you're trying, as a hunter, trying to figure out, okay, what do I do with this? It could be an extended period of time. And not everybody has the capacity to, you know, debone a deer carcass and hold that meat until the test results get back before they take it to a processor or do whatever they're going to do with it. Essentially, we just, you know, would recommend if you cannot hold that meat before you get your test results back, to basically, once you take it to a processor and you know, the processor is provides you that final product, so hold it until the test results are obtained. Again, you know, that is one of the things that we've heard a lot from a lot of different hunters, is the time that it takes is a concern, and, you know, we'll do what we can to expedite that as much as possible, but we unfortunately we can't results around in a couple of days. Wish we could, not reality at this point.
Right.
That's good.
Does the state have, like, on the website or somewhere, a list of your CWD certified processors?
Yes. There, on our website, there is a list of all of those certified facilities that hunters can reference.
Are those statewide, or is it just in that DSA zone?
They're statewide.
Okay, good. I was just thinking if you were to, okay.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah.
This Talk here. I just thought maybe I'd see if I can add a little mud to the water, actually hopefully clear things up just a little bit, because it is a little murky, and it's important, I think, We had a couple opportunities to answer these questions last week. So let me add a couple things to this conversation.
Absolutely.
That may or may not help. And really, just to clarify, Bob did a wonderful job explaining what your options are. But I just want to make sure folks understand that there are a couple different types of taxidermists out there, if you will. That the certified processors in taxidermists are just folks that have agreed to watch a 20-minute presentation and get behind our efforts to control the spread of CWD through proper disposal of carcasses and waste and so on and so forth. So some of those processors and taxidermists may be participating with us. That's probably the larger of the two groups, because I think we participated with about 56 different taxidermists this past year that pulled samples for us. Some of those taxidermists have been working for us for 4 or 5 years, maybe just a touch longer in some cases. So that's another group. So there maybe a subset of the certified. I don't know how best to characterize this, but there are certified taxidermists that may or may not pull samples for us. They could probably figure, if they don't, in other words, we have a, I wouldn't call it a contract, but we have an arrangement with them. They may collect 30, 40, or even just as few as 12 samples for us a season. And some of these folks that have been pulling samples for us, unfortunately, are not certified. So it's important for folks to understand, taking your deer to a taxidermist that is pulling samples for the Division of Wildlife may not necessarily be the same as meeting your obligation to taking your deer to a taxidermist that is certified. Okay. I hope that's clear. There are two types of folks out there. So it's important that folks understand. Ideally, we would get, all of those taxidermists that are working for us certified, but it's unlikely that we'll get the certified taxidermist to all pull samples for us. It's just, too busy, not interested, whatever the case may be. So I just want to make that distinction. And finally, for your situation, you got a trophy buck. You absolutely positively don't want anyone cutting on. You go to a taxidermist that's not working for us. He's certified, but he's not pulling samples for us. At the end of the day, if you really were interested in knowing, you could request, the carcass from him, get it to, one of our, call our district office. We'd find a way to either A, coach you through cutting the samples out. We have videos available. There's several online that will show you. It's a pretty simple process. Or you could potentially get it to one of our district offices, one of our work units. We're going to do what we can to get your deer tested if it's that important to you. It's just that obviously the bucks that are going to be mounted, as you would imagine, create a few speed bumps for us, but they're not insurmountable.
So this is just the kind of scientific side of my brain working. I haven't used it in a while, but the way I understand this disease, it's the prion or prion that is causing the issue. Is there any concern with people pulling samples and spreading this more than they would if they had just left it in place? I mean, because whatever I've seen that prion can last in the soil forever. It can last, it can be heated up to whatever, 1400 degrees and not die and that kind of stuff. And if we're just like pulling samples and then tossing, knives around, put it in the dishwasher, whatever, like that, is that something that is of a concern at all? Or is this treated like a hazmat in a doctor's office type of thing?
Well, I'm going to let others jump in, but I'll start the conversation. I'll start the answer. And Andrew, that's certainly a great question. It's a question that is debated, and we are debating currently. I'll take it down to let's go back to the Killdeer Plains refuge. Does it make sense to leave roadkill deer, for instance, on the side of the highway that may potentially be positive, or anywhere else in the state for that matter? Now, obviously, we don't know that they're positive unless we pull them and test them. But I think some will argue that it makes sense to remove them from the landscape because they're their potential source for future infections. You've got scavengers, You got crows, you got coyotes, you know, potentially moving prions across the landscape, as opposed to loading those up. If you've ever watched, a highway maintenance worker load a deer with a come along into the back of a pickup and drive off with perhaps that wonderful goo that's coming out the back, you know, for the next, 400 yards, which is the best approach? And so I don't know that we all on this call would agree, what the best approach is, especially when you've got the disease established. Does it make sense to leave it lay? And of course, then there's the question that comes up sort of tangentially when you have this conversation is, all right, so I'm a landowner in the DSA. Why do I need to bag my deer rather and set it out for trash pickup rather than taking it back? And I think that's an apples and orange question for sure. It's why would you take a deer from the field, process it in your pole barn, and knowingly take the waste back out and dump it on the landscape? Unless that was your only option. If you didn't have trash pickup, yeah, let's bury it then rather than putting it back on the back 40. But to leave a deer lay along the roadside undisturbed, I think that's a totally separate issue. But, as far as hunters processing and concern there, we recommend, a bleach solution for cleaning utensils. I think, once you get that deer home and you're working on it yourself, I think there's opportunities, to be careful and clean. And obviously there's no way of knowing whether how big of a prion load you're dealing with. Lots of unanswered questions, but I'd say probably the poster child, with, if you will, for this debate about spreading the disease really comes down to moving deer on the landscape that may or may not be positive in a zone that we know we've got CWD. But I'm rambling now, so I'm going to ask Clint or Bob to fill in if there's other things to be mentioned that I'm overlooking.
Yeah, I don't know that I have much else to add. Andrew, would you have any follow-up questions to anything that Tonk mentioned there?
No, I mean, I think the way I look at it, and our listeners know, I'm kind of a natural skeptic, and it's not that I don't buy into CWD at all. Don't take it that way. But man, it's biology. There's so much going on, right? And we hear stories about deer, a buck that traveled, 180 miles during the rut, and like he could move it, and then you've got all the and I don't know how much of it's just misinformation or not knowing. I think one of the things that we talked about before, Tonk, like we're learning about a lot of this. There's a lot of research going on and how to take care of this stuff, and it's maybe apples or not apples to apples, but it's very comparable to other issues going on in the world that maybe humans are dealing with. But like how we can all work together and, to protect the deer population by doing stuff that's basically common sense and just making sure that when you do process your deer, you're taking some of these considerations in the back of your mind and trying to help where you can, even though it may help, may not. It's everybody doing their kind of part, right? So,
yeah. And I think it's just erring on the side of caution in a lot of cases, just because we don't truly know the full impact in a lot of these scenarios. So as a state agency, it is our job to err on the side of caution, if that makes any sense to you, that we just ask our hunters to, in your case with pulling samples or what to do with your carcass, just it's in the best interest of everyone to err on the side of caution and dispose of that carcass or that waste properly. Again, just because there are still several unanswered questions with regards to prions and how they move and how long they stay active and where they stay active and what they bind to and all those sorts of things.
Yep. Paul, do you have any?
Yeah, I think.
Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I'm sorry. Nope. I'll just follow up with that because I think that's a great point and a great segue into something that we have done and will do our entire careers, and that's strike a balance. And that, in this case, that balance is between erring on the side of caution, but not so far that we push you guys to the curb and you decide, you know what, that's a little too much caution for me. You know, when you start taking away things that make hunting what you've come to call hunting, you know, whether it's bathing and feeding, whether it's, you know, whether it's urine, natural based urines, carcass restrictions, you know, we've got to be mindful of that as well. So we're continually checking, erring on the side of caution with how do we make sure that we don't make this so difficult and so unenjoyable that we lose you guys. So that's the other thing that state agencies are constantly doing is balancing that, you know, the odds of losing you because we're making things too restrictive or too demanding or too many, you know, you can't even understand the rules. So you decide it enough's enough, as opposed to, you know, throwing all caution to the wind on the other side. We're trying to find that middle ground.
You know, Tonk, I think the first time we talked, we spoke about what you guys do at the state with that balancing act of wildlife biology and realistically people's feelings. And that's a tightrope that I didn't realize that you guys walked every day. And I found that, one, fascinating, and two, I'm sure that is really frustrating at times. So Andrew, if you mind, I'd like to, and you guys on this call, I'd like to jump into the rule changes that the Wildlife Council approved earlier this year, specifically in that deer surveillance area, that three counties, Hardin, Marion, and Wyandotte County. So, and Tonk, you just talked about kind of, you know, limiting opportunities for hunters. We've got deer archery season up there, September 10th, February 5th. That's brand new. The early deer gun, October 8th to October 10th, and then everything else falls in line, youth deer gun, deer muzzleloader throughout the state in those zones. So we've got two new seasons, early gun, early archery. What's the one, why were those two, you know, deer gun, early archery, why did we choose those? And two, what's kind of the goal of those extended seasons, if you will?
Yeah, so Paul, I'll start out, and again, happy to have others chip in here. Clint and I were working collaboratively on these. The idea there, guys, is, you know, I to take this down to a level that because some days my science brain doesn't work either. But to take this down to a level that I think we all can get our head wrapped around, we're dealing with a deer disease. And so obviously we're not going to eliminate the deer as a means to eliminate the disease, but if we can buy some time, if you will, by reducing the deer population to the point where two things happen. Number one, positives are potentially removed, if not, at least interact with fewer deer. And number two, fewer deer on the landscape would also, we believe, contribute to lower likelihood. There's still going to be deer that are going to be dispersing out of the area. But the bigger picture is, let's just think about this as, you know, if we're going to manage a disease, we need to manage the deer population. And I think, Andrew, you started this conversation mentioning your experience there at the Kildare Plains Refuge, you know, the number of deer that you saw. So we certainly have a deer population issue that we have really done a good job of addressing, but need to continue to address. And I will say this, and make no mistake, we certainly have to work with landowners and get them on board, because there are properties in the vicinity, you know, within a stone's throw of the refuge that are really, they need to join us in our efforts to reduce local deer numbers there, for sure. So we thought that the seasons, the additional opportunities, would help us to meet that end goal of lowering deer populations. Now, the idea there is even if And I think we've all, you know, we all realize this. We probably talked about it once before. You know, there's a finite number of deer hunters are going to kill, and we recognize that, at least right now, until there are some substantive changes that we can make and hunter attitudes towards deer and they have more vacation time, whatever. There's going to be a finite number of deer that I think hunters are willing to take each year. So that said, even if you know, so then you ask the question, well, why bother with, you know, messing up the system and adding a couple additional seasons? I think the answer there is that earlier, all else being equal, even if we harvested the same number of deer, guys, earlier is better than later. If we can prevent those deer from dispersing, if we can remove a few extra bucks before they, you know, Andrew, you mentioned take off for that 180-mile trek around the county or associated counties, adjacent counties, then we're going to be better, you know, that much better off. Yeah, at the end of the season, we may harvest the same number of deer, but again, all else being equal, removing those deer before they can disperse, before they can deposit, the positive deer can continue to deposit prions and infect other deer. The better off we're going to be. So that's really the rationale is that if we're going to manage a deer disease, we've got to manage the deer population. And the hope is not to reduce, clearly we're not taking the deer population down to a level that, you know, folks have never seen before, but we'd like to reduce deer populations, knowing that in turn that should, eliminate, a few dispersers, maybe a few positives, and ultimately, again, you've talked about some, you know, we've talked about some success stories before, in different states. And I mentioned that the reality is it's probably here to stay, but we don't have to walk away from it, and throw our hands up in the air. You know, we're still in a position, if we can eliminate it, we can certainly keep it low for as long as we'd like to make that investment.
So will the USDA be involved still in harvesting deer in those three counties, or is that just to kind of like that initial big testing push that you guys did?
Well, that's to be decided yet. I'd like to, you know, long range planning. If we're not going to do that, we can probably expect, to follow in the footsteps of most every other state that has not. And that is, you know, continue expansion and increase in prevalence.
So one of the things that I've heard at wildlife council meetings, with the public and just general conversations with people is there's this perception that the state's goal, the USDA's goal, is zero deer. So let's wipe the deer herd population out in these CWD hot zones and then hit the reset button and start over. So that's not the goal, right?
Yeah, absolutely not.
You Paul, know, that, take that, your tinfoil hat off.
I'm not a deer hunter, so I'm just repeating what.
Yeah.
What I hear. Because I look at it and I'm like, that's not what they want to do. And it's important to hear you say, the people that are literally in charge of the deer herd population in the state, that's not our goal. Our goal is to not wipe out the deer population and start over. So I think that's important.
Paul, you know what? I'm going to take those words right out of your mouth there and repeat it for the group. The group that, you know, we're talking to the people that are literally in charge of the deer population. The reality is we're not. We set season frameworks. That's all that we do. It's up to folks like Andrew and the landowners in the DSA and the hunters in the DSA to buy into that season framework and pull the trigger to release the arrow. We do not control. Make no mistake. We set the seasons. We set the bag limits. We encourage. We educate. Right. I mean, but at the end of the day, this is private property. So all that we can do is hope that we can communicate our goals and our intentions to the hunting public, to the landowners. And I tell you, Bob, I got to put a plug in for Bob, because clearly he nailed down over 15,000 acres for us to get access to. And so great job, Bob. It probably helps that he lives in the neighborhood. He's just a great looking guy, goes to church with these folks. And so he's able to get permission. And so that's what we're talking about in terms of conveying to the people that actually do manage the deer population that, hey, we've got the best of intentions here. We'd like for you to allow us, you know, to implement these plans, and we got the support. Now we need to work on, you know, a few more hunters. And I think that's, you know, that's where moving forward, that's what, where we're going to be is focusing on developing that, continue to develop that communication plan that dialogue and get those landowners who control access to the property and control access to some of those very, very large deer populations on board with us.
So will there be more permits issued to landowners in the DSA, private landowners, to harvest, you know, does or?
So we're actually talking about that right now, as a matter of fact, and it's certainly not too soon to be thinking about the fall of 22, because it's going to be right around the corner, unfortunately. But you know, one of the things that we have to do is, you know, we have to step through. It's an iterative process. Unfortunately, we know where we'd like to be, but we have to take probably four or five turns rather than a direct route, because that's just the nature of the business. So we need to get folks, we need to build buy-in, we need consent, and we need folks to understand. For instance, many hunters want to do the job that USDA Wildlife Services did. Could you imagine hunters shooting 180 deer in four nights? Add the hours up. I mean, that's just not, but hunters do have a very important role, and I need to remind folks of that. You know, they were the ones, a hunter in 2020 got us onto this situation, right? With their hunter harvested deer submitted to a taxidermist that's cooperating with us. So hunters have a vital role in this, but they also need to understand that we were there to kill deer, not to hunt deer with that postseason removal. And so, I mean, this comes back to our ability to effectively and repeatedly communicate what our end game is, you know, what our goals are. And it's not zero deer. I mean, that's absolutely positively, make no mistake, that's not it for sure. You know, we need to, and I've said this, you know, Tuesday and Thursday of last week, countless times, it comes down to what the hunters in the area and the landowners are willing to support. We can make no decisions on private property without their permission. So it really is, it's about the job that we have is not killing deer, but communicating folks what we'd like to see happen and lay out for them the options that are before us.
I'm going to just make a connection. I hope that you guys have already done this, but your counterpart, Dave Kohler, running the OLAP property, might be something there. Open up access in those areas.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you, Bob, if you found 15,000 acres to get access to do your work, to do your research, you know, it might make sense. I'd go up there. I have no problems going up there at all. So, Munts, what else you got?
Well, just as we wind this down, I want to take a few minutes, and Bob, just to focus on Kill Deer Plains wildlife area, kind of specifically. So for those who are not familiar, we're talking Hardin, Wyandotte, Marion County area. It was near Kenton, Upper Sandusky. They're kind of some of the towns that are a little bit nearby. But Bob, can you give us a quick rundown on the background of the wildlife area, what it has to offer? I mean, when I was there, I think it's about 9,000 acres. The wildlife is plentiful. There was three or four bald eagles in the one field one morning, and then the turkeys just walking around everywhere, and coyotes and geese, and it's got all kinds of fun stuff.
It does. Kildare Plains Wildlife Area is one of the most unique areas that I work on, for sure. It is, as you said, a little over 9,200 acres. About 3,000 acres of that 9,200 is wildlife refuge, which means that it is controlled access, and the only way for anybody to go into that portion of the property is by permit only. That is the area where we offer all of our controlled hunting opportunities, from waterfowl to deer, and turkey, as you guys have mentioned earlier. It was purchase of the land was started clear back in 1952, and it through the years it has become one of the main priority areas in this part of the state for bird watching. There's just a tremendous amount of wildlife there and different species there. Birding is extremely popular, in addition to all of the consumptive wildlife recreational opportunities that Kildare offers. So, 6,000, a little over 6,000 acres is open access. So people can go there, traverse, hunt whatever is in season, watch whatever they can come across, and the 3,000 acres would be the, you know, access by permit only.
How much of that 6,000 acres would you say is wooded? Because that was one thing I noticed. It's almost got that marsh feel for a lot of it. Not a ton of huge stands of woods, but I mean, there's some, but.
Yeah, it's a very minimal percentage of the acreage. I think across the entire property, all 9,200 acres, there's probably maybe, 1,000 to 1,500 acres that are wooded. Kildare Plains is primarily managed as a grassland and wetland complex. It historically was a wet prairie area, and that prairie, you know, covered about approximately 30,000 acres historically. So it is home to a large number of state-listed and some federally listed species of wildlife and plants. So there's a lot of there's some areas where we have the remnant prairies that actually occurred there historically. And so yeah, it's certainly the forested areas are extremely important, but the primary management of the area is that wetland grassland complex.
So as I mentioned, the one of the things I took away from there, besides I didn't get a turkey, was that there are a lot of deer. And I guess I'm just looking for your kind of opinion. We talked about the CWD. We talked about what the wildlife area has to offer. Do you guys have too many deer up there? And the reason I ask is because when I was driving in and out in the dark, I said this on one of the last shows, but it was like a big buck hunter. You know that video game where like the deer unrealistically just continue to jump out? And it was like every 100 yards, it was like, up, there's four more. Up, there's three more. You know, just constantly again and again and again. And the one morning, I mean, we might have bumped the same ones a few times. I don't know, but I swear we saw 50 deer before 8:30 in the morning. And I'm sitting there, I'm just like, as a primarily a deer hunter, I'm supposed to be looking for birds, but all I'm watching are these white tails running away. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, there's a lot of deer here. So it's almost like no wonder to me that you could maybe have a disease problem, but also offering these extended hunts and stuff. Is that kind of the consensus, or was I just an anomaly when I was up there?
No, that is, you know, majority of people that participate in opportunities to access the refuge area have those comments. We do have a high deer density on the property, and as Mike and Clint have discussed, that extends out to the surrounding properties, private properties as well. So, when we started these controlled deer hunts on the refuge historically, which, preceded my tenure, with the division, it was, designed for some, quality, opportunities. And the problem is with all of this is everybody's opinion, it's something that's really subjective. What is, what is the quality hunt? What is an adequate deer population? Some folks think, adequate is a deer behind every tree and corn stalk. Others just, think that if they see something, that's an awesome day. And so it's kind of hard to, put a finger on, navigating through this, this issue, especially, the chronic wasting disease and targeted removals and whatnot. But, I guess to answer your question, we do have a high deer density on the property. We have expanded our controlled hunting opportunities through our lottery drawings. We have archery hunts from the beginning of archery season up till youth gun. Then we change over to our gun hunts. We offer hunting opportunities to mobility impaired folks, youth, and the general, all applicants anybody who wants to apply. So, and we run those hunts clear to the end of the season. Not every day, but, you know, the gun hunts typically occur on Saturdays. So gives the deer a little chance to rest in between, for the rest of the week, and makes the hunting opportunity a little more productive. But, you know, our goal with these hunts is to expand that opportunity and to, you know, hopefully harvest a greater number of deer than what we have historically in the past. So we're changing over more from just a opportunity quality hunt to a management hunt, and hopefully the participants in that management hunt perspective will have quality opportunities as well.
Awesome. And as far as the lottery hunts and stuff go, that's stuff that everybody can apply for as they're buying their license and their tags and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. Watch for announcements. Certainly monitor the Division of Wildlife's website, but usually the application period is during the month of July. So, in order to apply for those controlled hunts, you would need to log in just like you're going to buy a license, and there should be a tab to select for controlled hunts, and then you can select those hunts that you would want to participate in. So, but that will be during the month of July.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll make sure we keep everybody up to speed on that.
Hey, Andrew.
Yes, sir.
This is Clint. I did want to mention that, you know, yeah, we do have, there are a lot of deer up there at Killdeer, but they're, believe it or not as many as there used to be. You saw a lot of deer back in turkey season. That was after hunting season, and that was after targeted removals. So, you know, in all likelihood, that's the lowest the deer population is going to be throughout the whole year. But if I'll take you back a couple of years and just give you a rundown of what we've seen, because we've been doing aerial surveys on the refuge over the last several years. The first year in February 2020, so two years ago, we counted 300 deer in the refuge. February 2021, 283. February 2022, just a couple months ago, 186. So these expanded opportunities appear to be they're obviously resulting in more dead deer. I think hunters on the controlled hunts this year killed over 200 deer on the refuge. But those increased harvests are resulting in the population moving in the direction that we'd like for it to go.
That's awesome. And that's great. I love the numbers because it really shows you what's going on. So Clint, you're pretty quiet through most of that, man, but I have to say one of the most intriguing things I've heard so far is that you get to fly around in a helicopter and count deer. I mean, I think that sounds like the ultimate profession.
Only if I was able to fly the helicopter would it be the ultimate profession.
that takes scouting to a new level, you know.
Yeah.
So
it's a lot of fun.
Good. Well, gentlemen, if there's anything else that you have to share, if not, we really appreciate your time. I think this is great to, from hunters on the ground across the state. We appreciate you. We appreciate all the work you're putting in and to help this herd and keep everything moving in the right direction in the long run. And we look forward to talking to you again someday.
Andrew, I do have a thought that I'd like to share with the group before we close. We've been plugging folks all along, the hunters for the work that they've been doing, the landowners for the access that they've given us. Clearly, the work that Bob and his staff and our agency has put forth in terms of trying to address these large deer numbers. And I think it's also worth plugging. And because we don't get plugged very often, well, it just doesn't happen. But I want to say you know, there's a genuine effort on the part of this agency really to address, and I'm segueing here, but there's a legitimate effort on the part of this agency to address the deer population in that area. And nothing speaks more to that than the steps, not only supporting the controlled hunts, and the postseason removals, but the year that we found 2020 after that season, the agency did something unprecedented that you may or may not be aware of. And that is, they gave folks an opportunity that participated in some of those late season controlled hunts to harvest as up to, I believe, 4 or 5 additional deer. And those could have been antlered deer, could have been booners if they wanted to, just to, just to address the local deer population. So hats off to them. And I'd say, again, my segue here is that we really, because you understand the country, you've traveled there now, you know what it looks like. We bump the deer off the refuge. If they're going to another refuge, you know, we're sort of dead in the water in terms of our ability to manage that herd. So we really need not only landowners to continue to provide access, but we need hunters that are willing to step up and support the effort by taking maybe an additional deer or 4. and I know that's a lot to ask, but I think together, we've got a great plan moving forward, and together, only together, are we going to be successful. And success is not eliminating CWD. Let's be honest, that's not going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen, but we can contain it. We can find a way to live with it. We can keep it from moving around to the degree possible if we all decide to work together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, guys, have a great rest of your day. Enjoy the summer as we lead up. One of you guys said that we were starting to talk about fall. Well, some of us have already started thinking about fall, like a couple weeks ago when we were out chasing birds and couldn't find them. Then we're ready for deer season to start. So, but you guys have a great day. Appreciate your time.
See you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
See you, Paul.